Jaspreet Boparai and Don Nicholson with Greenwashed on RCR, Reality Check Radio.
Hello and welcome. You're with Greenwashed. I'm Jaspreet here with Don Nicholson. And today we have on for the third time in the last, we've been going for about 18 months in Greenwashed, and we have Taranaki-based energy consultant Larry Blair back in the house, as I said, Larry, for the third time. But as before I get you on here, I will look back to last year. It was July, nearly a year to date, when we first had you on, Don and I. And I'm seeing a replay of that interview up on the Reality Check Radio website. And the byline there goes with New Zealand's negativity to oil and gas exploration leave us vulnerable. Boy, did you call it, or did you call it? Welcome.
Yeah. Hi, Jeffrey. How you doing? Yeah, I was late to the party, but yeah, even then.
I know.
But I was looking back at that myself actually a while ago and realized that was almost a calendar year as well. And what was interesting was that the MBIE at the time, Ministry of Business, Innovation, Employment, were in the paper at the time saying that we had plenty of gas and we've got enough gas to see us through to 2050 transition or something like this. And I was scratching my head. I couldn't see where they were getting those numbers from. So here we are.
And now we have this list of businesses that say they are struggling. Like in recent times, what have I heard of? I've heard of Electric EV saying it can't take on any more customers. We've had Winstone Pulp that is saying for 14 days its plant is being shut down near between Ohakune and Wairu. OG Fibers in Penrose has got 75 jobs on the line because the power prices from September 21 to now, so within 3 years, have gone from $100 per megawatt hour to over $800 per megawatt hour. Down here, we have Open Country in Southland that is talking of the additional cost it's being saddled with, having been forced to have coal as a backup to its electrified boilers. So all of this is going on. And yet for someone like you, this doesn't come as a surprise. Not in the least, I'm thinking.
No. Well, I mean, New Zealand's got our mix of electricity generation has always been around about 85% of it's from the hydro schemes. So you can see when we don't have rain, that's a problem. And then what we back that up with is all thermal stuff, typically. We've got about 10, I think it's just a bit under 10% or something like 7% maybe, renewable stuff in the grid. But the balance that makes up the shortfalls is all thermal stuff. So that's your coal and your gas, typically. And what's happened is that the gas production rates have dropped right off quite rapidly. I think all of the field operators are all struggling with late life wells and late life operations, and the wells get quite finicky when they get old, and they don't have that, there's not a lot of pressure driving underneath them. So if you have to shut them in for any reason, it's very hard to get them restarted. Sometimes you don't get them restarted. You can shut in for a short period of time and then end up with a lot of water issues that you've got to try and overcome to get going again. And so they need to be treated with care. And now we're in the situation where, those what we can put into a market at any given time and it's very difficult to meet the contracts, actually, to be honest, even at the moment with the gas the way it is. Yeah.
What we are being told, though, mainly in the media by those who are responsible, for the decisions that have led us to this point, is that it's rain. It's a shortage of rain. Everything else was going to plan. It's just the fact that our lake levels are really low. So is that all there is to it?
No. It's a double whammy this time. So it's both a lack of rain and a lack of gas. So we haven't noticed as much the lack of rain in the past because we've had the gas available. This time we don't have the gas available, so we're noticing it when we don't have rain.
So when was it the last time, Larry, and if that was something that you know of, and you were at this stage in the lakes?
I think it was 2008. Don't quote me on that. I'm not 100% sure, but I think it was something like 2008 was the last we had a real dry period.
Well, I've certainly been here before.
That happens often, Don, and this is the predictable nature of it. I mean, you might call me a little bit, well, you probably won't actually, but they're crazy, but I actually use Ken Ring's books quite a lot, and I buy his Weather Almanac, and you know, he's predicting almost only about a third of the rain for September that we would normally have on average. So this is it. It's quite a tenuous situation we see ourselves in if his sort of predictions are come to fruition.
Yeah, it is. But you know, on top of all that, I actually think you have a right to gloat, actually, Larry. But on the other side of it, because you did get it right, you called it. This country has embarked on this electrification process, and it's given a lot of taxpayer protection to industry to electrify itself. But it doesn't seem to have said at the same time, oh, we need to go and have some really reliable electron flow. We've decided we'll go through this intermittent phase of solar and wind, and you know, we know what their nameplate says they'll generate, and it is, without a storage option, pretty fickle. So we've done it to ourselves. I mean, we've said let's electrify everything. I mean, as Jaspreet alluded to earlier, we've got industry in the south electrifying itself, but they're still having to have their coal or lignite backup because there isn't enough electrons guaranteed. So isn't it a case of government policy effectively setting us up to fail? And on the other side of it, the big players, sorry to interrupt, the bigger players know that this market is tenuous. And, you know, perhaps they haven't just done their contracting of their electricity needs good enough. And, of course, they're having to play the spot market for the extra and pay a high price. I mean, it seems like all the cards, all the, what's the word? Everything's come home to roost at one time. But a lot of this was so predictable.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, so my take on the predictability of it was the weakness of the gas, and as you've highlighted before, and that was based on, I was just watching over, you know, the last probably 5 years. Each year we'd say we had so many petajoules of reserves in the 2P profile, and then we'd use, say, 200 petajoules, but then we'd have a write down of 400, right? So where'd the other 200 go, right? It's just our inability to accurately estimate what's actually in these reservoirs, right? And you've seen that consistently year on year on year. So the reserves are going down and down and down faster than we were using them. So that was where the first sort of red flag came up for me. If you were to talk to probably guys like Brian Leyland and stuff that have a lot more history in the electrical market and can know much more of the nuance of it than I do. But what essentially happened was that in the Think Big era, we built all this hydro schemes, right? And we overbuilt capacity. So we had far more capacity than we needed, right? And to the point where, you know, people would, you know, allegedly not insulate their houses and stuff because it was easier just to stick a fan heater in each room, right? Because the electricity was so cheap. And what we've done over time is that we've actually grown as a country and as a nation, and our demand is growing, and we're now consuming all of that generation essentially. On paper not, but in practical realities that we're sort of maxed out now. So at the same time, we've gone to this free market model where we've sold state-owned enterprises to private ownership, you know, government saying retained controlling share in some cases, that sort of thing. And there's definitely a case for that, you know, private enterprise is a lot more efficient than the government at running things. But what it's ultimately done now is that we don't have that free capacity in the system anymore. And not only do we have a lack of free capacity on the generation side, we now have a constraint on the fuel side. Which is where the gas is. So we're running up against two sort of constraints concurrently, which is making it very, very difficult. And what the ultimate outcome of all of this is it just becomes really expensive or impossible to do business in New Zealand. And that's not good for anyone that lives here or calls New Zealand home. You know, it's I despair this week when I'm seeing all the newspapers are saying, you know, Methanex has decided to shut down operations for 3 months, and they're going to on-sell their gas into the market, but they'll make us more money than they would if they were producing methanol. And I'm like, oh my. But this is somehow a great news story. Like, it's happy days. Everyone's clapping and cheering because we've warded off the potential of blackouts because we've now got this extra gas in the market. And I'm like, this is a disaster. You know, this is a business that's probably generating something like $1 billion in export revenue. So, you know, what does this do to the balance of trade? You know, the power price is still going to be high because the gas is being sold at a high premium, right? Yeah, it's...
And you can't blame Methanex.
It's really bad. Yeah,
we've had Harvey Week here speaking about this, about Methanex, and you can't blame them for at this time choosing to use their gas reserves, so selling it on the spot market. If you're getting $800 per megawatt hour, yeah, you'd be a fool not to. But the lost productivity, the perverse outcomes there.
But and when you expand the go to the widest boundary analysis and you go, what does this mean for New Zealand Inc? It's not good. Mm-hmm. And then if you're doing the same with sawmills, all our big TYs, I think, doing some demand management to help keep things afloat as well. So you've got all these big heavy industries in New Zealand that are now constrained on their production side, right? Which means that they're going to sell less product, which means they're going to earn less revenue for the country, which is going to hit the crown revenue or the government's books really hard. And this is the reality of being energy constrained. All we do is take materials and energy and process them together and produce things. That's
Yeah, well, it's interesting. Last Thursday, August the 8th, there was a post put up by a guy on No Right Turn. And his last paragraph was this: meanwhile, it's a bit rich for the major energy users group to be complaining. They've known that the market works like this for 25 years. They are large, well-capitalized companies. If they wanted lower prices, they've had 25 years to build cheap renewable generation to drive the expensive price-setting fossil fuel stations out of the market. But they haven't, because that would be investment as opposed to mere rent seeking. They're simply reaping what they've sowed. And if the leopards are now eating their faces, I see no reason not to have some popcorn while they scream. Now, he goes under the moniker of idiot savant.
Yeah, well, he'll say that until he goes to the dentist and it costs, you know what I mean? There's zero, like, the government can't afford to subsidize his, dentist's probably a bad example, but even the doctor, right? Like, this is the thing.
But is that sort of right? Because no business is going to invest in new generation while there's a market mechanism that says if there's a surplus of electrons, the price is going to go down to such a point there's no justification. We'll just take those cheap electrons. So we've got a problem. My question, Larry, is does the government have a role in setting up that sort of reserve generation like they used to have, I think, through the diesel generators at Whirinaki? They had that reserve capacity. But that meddles with the market as well. So where does the meddling begin and end is probably the question.
Well, I look at it this way, Don. Like, you know, what's the argument for building roads, right? We have this debate quite often, right? Why do we build a road, right? It's so that we've got infrastructure, right? And the infrastructure will support businesses, you know. And if we build better roads, then goods get to market quicker and more efficiently, and it benefits the economy and all this sort of stuff. And we've really got to start thinking about energy and power, in particular electricity, in the same way. It's infrastructure for modern societies to do business. It's not. We don't need like a sealed road so that the horses don't sink into the mud anymore. You know, we also need to be able to run plant and heavy machinery and all this sort of stuff. So you start to get into the point where I think that that the electrical network and the generation side is almost infrastructure. It needs to be treated as infrastructure rather than a commodity on a commodities market. That, I think, answers the question that, yes, it probably is a role for government to be involved. But that scares the hell out of me because the government's not particularly good at anything, right?
No. I agree, although the argument again would be that prior to the privatization regime of the century with the electricity generators, was it Electricorp ran everything, and it just provided, but we didn't have a massively expanding population. We didn't have the electrification profile that we've got now. We didn't have more people in the country. And we didn't have climate change policies that are driving us to this net zero nirvana. So there's a whole lot of things come to haunt us all at once. And we obviously didn't prepare for it. Now, the other day I also read that to meet the new demand, I missed AI and data centers and all of that. Mm-hmm. To meet our new demand by 2040, we'll need between 35 and 40 new large-scale generation plants in New Zealand. Now, I would suggest to you that with the RMA and with the rules and regulations we have in this country, that's going to be an impossibility to get that sort of investment in time.
Yeah, exactly. That's the problem, right? It's almost impossible to build anything here anymore. You know, the amount of red tape and bureaucracy and even renewing existing consents for existing stuff is just eye-wateringly expensive and kind of crazy. Mm. That's definitely a problem. But it's interesting you mentioned that. I stumbled across something a while ago, and it was a paper by an atmospheric scientist from Utah State, and he studies the thermodynamics of snowflakes, actually. But believe it or not, the economic model, you can almost, well, it actually works as a thermodynamic model, right? So, but what that means, without getting into all sorts of technicalities, is that you basically need to grow your primary energy by exactly the same amount as you want to grow your GDP. So if you wanted to say what we want 2% per annum GDP growth, you basically need 2% per annum net primary energy growth, and that's across all forms, of course. But it's not just electricity, but it would be very similar for electricity as well. You know, that would, you'd need to grow your electrical network by 2% at least. And maybe more if you want to bias more towards electrification. So that's the answer right there, right, is how much you need. When you think that's compounding, you almost need to double what you've got in terms of electrical generation within the next 30 years.
And I would add a caveat on that. You also need to keep in mind the amount of population growth. We've had record numbers of immigration over the last couple of years. That also needs to be factored in. There's all these people coming and infrastructure is not nearly keeping pace. And of course, what price are you willing to pay for it? Which at the end of it, which energy is good, regardless, I don't care where it comes from, as long as I flick a button and it's there. But the cost matters. And we seem to have totally forgotten about that in the virtue signaling here.
For sure. I just think that every country, you know, the only countries you see that are really prosperous are the ones that have cheap, abundant energy, you know. Mm. And this is where we, you know, we're struggling to retain the businesses we've got, and we're certainly not attracting any new ones, is the current scenario with the current market the way it is.
Yeah.
So, I agree with that. It's very hard to attract investment. So we're sitting on masses of hydrocarbon reserves in this country on land. It's just in the form of lignite and coal. Do you think there's a chance we'll go back to that and actually sort of unlock the economy? Like, I know of processes that can make lignite to diesel, for instance, and I imagine those processes are improving all the time. Do you think there's a need? Do you think there's going to be any appetite to change to that, or do you think change back to that, or will nuclear energy be this still the next sort of best thing because we still want to continue down this electrification track?
Yeah, the lignite to diesel would be a potential option for liquid fuels, for sure, for diesel, you know, or Germans came up with that technology back in World War I or II, I think it was, because they were constrained in terms of their ability to produce oil and gas, right? So so they were finding other ways to come up with liquid fuels for their air force. So it can be done, for sure. Is that something that's palatable? I don't know. I mean, at the moment, we're definitely increasing our coal use, so we can't say we're not. you know, we're filling the void that gas is leaving with coal. And that's, again, we're constrained a little bit there as well, because, you know, we've only got so much capacity to burn that as well, right, without adding new coal power stations. But, yeah, I think, you know, we are an energy-rich country, that's for sure. It's does someone have the vision and you know, the bold enough to go after those sorts of things and get them out there? At the moment, it's left to the market, and the market's not big enough. You know, there's not, and no one's prepared to take multi-billion-dollar risks to try and develop stuff. The only people talking those sorts of numbers at the moment are the offshore wind folks, and I wish them luck, because they've got a massive uphill battle, and I'm not sure that they'll help us much, even if they succeed, to be honest.
Yeah, it's interesting. I've never actually managed to reconcile the offshore wind prospects versus just putting the damn things on land. And I know people don't want them in their own backyard necessarily, but the infrastructure to get it from offshore to onshore seems all too hard to me compared to having onshore wind. The wind may blow better out at sea, I don't know, but it just doesn't, to the layman, it doesn't make sense.
It's a two-factor thing. So one, the wind is, it's a better profile of wind, but it also, it's a scale of economy thing. So, you know, it's this mad race to get the bigger and bigger turbines. So we've gone from sort of 4.5 megawatts up to 15 and a half or something like that, I think. Okay. is the latest ones. But they're so big. They've got so many challenges just engineering-wise with those things. And you can see already they're running into all sorts of issues with them. Mm-hmm. That Nantucket wind farm you may have read about in the news, you know, that it was only the first 11 turbines of 62 or something were in operation, and the first one fell to bits in 5 months. So,
who's behind that particular operation? Do we have those operators around here in New Zealand?
It's interesting that's a joint venture between Avangard and Copenhagen Investment Partners, I believe, for Vineyard Wind. And Copenhagen Investment Partners is also partnered with the New Zealand Super Fund for. What they're proposing is a 1 gigawatt wind farm off of South Taranaki Bight. So it's the same people, yeah.
Wow. Yeah. Okay, well, hopefully our resource management actually throws some hurdles in their way. I don't know, seeing the fact that those folks around Christchurch got so upset with the sale GP with offshore wind farms, one would expect to see a huge amount of public outrage, wouldn't we, Larry?
The offshore wind's got a huge amount of hurdles. One's a commercial hurdle. It's just super, super expensive. I mean, even they're publicly now saying they're looking for about $5.5 billion to do 1 gigawatt. That's the sort of capex they need.
So for our listeners, the ones who are not aware of the cost, Larry, compare that cost of 1 gigawatts of wind to, say, coal-fired. What's the cost differential there?
Coal... to build a coal-fired plant, I'm not sure, to be honest, Jeffrey, but it would be closer to, you know, hundreds of millions rather than
billions.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yep. And this is before the fact that you also, for our listeners who are unaware, Larry also blogs prolifically at his Substack. This one is newzealandenergy.substack.com. And you've had a great few posts there, but I'm going to read from this one in June, which I think I had read earlier as well, that you say that as I write this today, out of 1,259 megawatts of wind generating power that we have, a grand total of 35 megawatts is being generated. You read that right. Less than 3% of installed capacity. So that's the efficiency factor there. Of course, I understand that's at one particular point in time, but 3%.
Yeah, and so that's the next challenge, right, is that if you do build something like 1 gigawatt of offshore wind, how do you deliver that to the network? Because you've got to have a network that can handle 1 gigawatt or no gigawatts, and many variations of that throughout any given day. It's actually a reasonably interesting exercise to go and have a look at the generation profile of the wind farms. You only get data for onshore ones in New Zealand, but they are telling. It's like a big sawtooth, you know, with all sorts of jaggedy bits in it. So you've got to have a network that can handle that. So it's not like you can store energy in the network. The load and the supply need to be balance within milliseconds of each other, right? So how do you respond to that?
It's not like one of your dairy processors who are sort of they somehow adjust. They pull in additional tankers from another company at the time of their peak milk, drop it off when they don't need all those tires on the road and that metal. But you can't really do that. Energy is you need that constantly there.
Yeah, so I mean that's the next problem, and then do you socialize the cost of Transpower's network to try and deal with that? What sort of things do you add to the network to deal with that? Do you have to have some sort of pumped hydro somewhere that you can kind of take the peaks out and try and backfill the troughs a little bit, what are you using for firming? You know, are we now going to import LNG to do the firming to try and keep that profile matching the demand profile?
Yeah. We are talking of importing LNG, aren't we? There are ports now that have been told more recently by the minister that we're going to build an import terminal for under $100 million, possibly either Northland or Taranaki.
And
we have dropped year on year, is it close to 20% of our natural gas reserves from the Ministry of Business, Innovation and Employment, MB's papers. I understand half of that drop was due to we stopped drilling. The other half was they have somehow rationalized the reserves that they thought they were. And now we are in a position where we are going to have to import them, then build a terminal. Like, for me, this is a classic example of the government meddling in a market to the detriment of the common man, to the common man's wallet. And again, when this sort of, ports are going to be built and all of that, it's going to enrich someone, but it's not going to be the average Kiwi. We are the ones paying both ways.
Yeah. I mean, it's necessary probably.
Because they've done it. You know, they've done that to us.
Yeah, it is necessary. And it's probably one of the last resort options to try and keep things going at this stage. How you would do it, I would imagine, is you'd unload, and you've got to have a regasification unit for that. So it's liquid natural gas, right? And then you've got to regasify it, which is it's not a complicated process, but it's a
needs
process.
Needs some
infrastructure, yeah. And then you'd probably pump it from there into a Haroa or something, which is the it's a reservoir that New Zealand uses as a sort of a gas storage facility to buffer the pipeline with, yeah.
And you just look at it and I just think the waste, we didn't need to do all of this.
Well, the biggest issue with that, Jaspreet, is that you're now vulnerable to the market. I mean, you look at what happened to LNG prices when someone blew up the Nord Stream pipeline.
Yes.
It was the someone.
I know.
Yeah, but... yeah, look what happened to the global spot market for LNG at that point, and the markets and the demand's still pretty hot. I know the market's come back a lot and the prices are a lot more reasonable at the moment, but you've only got to have a brutally cold winter in Europe or something, and those prices are going to spike. And so what sort of arrangement are we setting up for that? Are we looking for long term contract at a fixed rate? Was Australia, It's really, and we're super vulnerable again. We're just vulnerable to shipping. We're vulnerable to
We don't have neighbors who can just turn on a pipeline. Yeah. Not happening.
Yeah, it's difficult compared to domestic construct, and it just adds more volatility to anyone trying to do business here, right? Like, how do you budget when did you buy things on a fixed rate and hedge it, or do you have to, it gets really complicated and it makes it difficult. And this is where some of the sawmills have run into trouble with the electricity prices too, because they've done, as I understand it, they've done sort of part fixed, part flip, variable spot market stuff, and it's the spot market stuff that's killed them. Yeah.
So just imagine you've got all this wind turbine stuff come offshore, and as you said, it's sort of spiky. We'd have a whole series of battery farms onshore to store the electrons, then we'll use it to electrolyze hydrogen. It's all really a bit nonsensical, isn't it? I mean,
well, it's all very Rube Goldberg. I don't know if you're familiar with Rube Goldberg, the cartoonist.
I see you've quoted that in one of your Substacks, but no, I'm not familiar, so explain.
Yeah, Rube Goldberg, he was a cartoonist back in the day. I think it was in the 50s or something. They're quite cool little cartoons. I'd encourage people to go and Google it and look them up. But it's like the super deluxe napkin opener or something, you know? So instead of just reaching across and opening it with your fingers, he's got all these levers and things and rubber bands and pulleys and stuff. And this, you know, it opens the napkin for him, you know? It's a super complicated way to do things. So, this is what happens when you take an intermittent, first you take a really low energy density source like the wind, right? It's low energy density, it's highly dispersed. So then you need a lot of infrastructure to harvest it, because low energy density equals high resource intensity. So then you take it on shore and you've got this product that's sort of up and down all over the place. It's kind of like trying to drive your car down the road, and it wants to go 100 kilometers an hour, and then it wants to stop, and then it wants to go 50, and then it wants to stop, and then it wants to go 100 again, and you're trying to make your way at an average speed of about 40 kilometers an hour to where you're going, but doing it in this sort of super erratic way. So to try and deal with that, you add all these other things in there, the batteries, and then you go power to X, which is your, you know, electricity to hydrogen and all this. But it's all complexity that you're adding in, which is all entropy, which is all losses, which makes it expensive and inefficient. It just becomes really, really expensive products.
Yes.
So much friction.
So we haven't talked about the sort of bogeyman in this whole energy mix, and that is nuclear. Now, off air, you told us about the cost per gigawatt hour that China can build a nuclear station for. And it just makes your eyes water when you know how much we're paying to do sort of some the equivalent sort of thing to build other types of energy sources. So in a gigawatt hour concept, can you say for sure that nuclear would be very viable because of its 95% efficiency perhaps, and its ongoing use, because it just doesn't fall apart in 20 years?
Yeah, so I think we have to go sort of probably update our models a little bit on nuclear. I think like all things, it's moved on since, you know, the days of Chernobyl and things like that. So we're up to a fourth generation reactor now. Now, there's not a lot of fourth generation reactors in the world. I think there's only one actually running, and that's in China. That would be a very expensive option. But what the benefit of a fourth generation reactor is it's totally fail safe. So it's got a gas exchanger unit that basically, so it doesn't need external cooling. So you wouldn't see things like Fukushima where you've got a tidal wave, takes out cooling water pumps, and then you run into issues. None of those sorts of problems. But if we look at best in class, and I'm no nuclear expert, so take this with a grain of salt, but if we look at best in class, we're probably looking at South Korea. So they've got about 26 reactors there that they run. Now, they've got a build cost, capex cost of around about 2.7 billion for 1.4 gigawatts. They use an APR 1400 as a typical reactor size they use. Now, we probably couldn't achieve anything like that in New Zealand, even if we contracted Korea to do it for us, because what they're doing is they're building a great big pad, and then they're putting multiple reactors on the pad, so they're sort of getting some scale of economy out of the civil works, which is something like 70% or 80% of the cost of a nuclear reactor. But let's say, for example, we doubled that and we went, okay, it's $5 billion for 1.4 gigawatts of nuclear, right? What's the capacity factor on that? It's 90%+, right? So it's more than double what we're going to achieve with the best offshore wind in terms of capacity factor. And then you say, well, what's the life cycle of it, right? And these, you know, the we've got second and third generation reactors out in the world at the moment that are sort of 80 years old and still going, right? So, and when you look at what's the cost to build another one, it's basically just putting a new reactor on that existing civil works, right? Like the civil works will last longer. So when you look at how long it takes to amortize the cost, it's actually not too bad. It's sort of similar to what New Zealand did with the hydro schemes, you know, which can now generate, you know, power incredibly cheaply when there's plenty of water. Yep.
Mm-hmm.
So, well, where to, if I sort of try to bring this discussion towards present day, where to from here? I saw your latest Substack, Larry, that was very aptly termed "eating the seed corn," because lake levels are going to be we are at such low levels, they'll have to go lower than typically what the resource constraints would permit. So where to from here, other than, of course, praying for rain over the next few months so that we don't face another winter? If you were in control, what would be your recipe to get out of this mess that we found ourselves in?
Yeah, it's easy to be a critic. It's not so easy to come up with an answer. I think what they're talking about doing with the hydro lakes, which to summarize for your listeners is basically they want to lower, they've got a resource consent that says you can draw the lake down to a certain level. And what they want to do is they want to increase that drawdown level so that they can increase the capacity, essentially. So go below the resource consented floor. Why I titled that "eating your seed corn" is because basically what that means is now that you've got not just recovering from record low level lake levels to build up again, you've got to build up extra because you've gone even deeper into your reserves, right? So, so unless we have an incredibly wet spring and summer and winter next year with a lot of snow melt as well, then we're going to run into the same issue next year. And the immediate answer is just going to be getting as much coal into the country as we can. That's the short term. Can they do something fast with LNG? I mean, maybe. Stu Kidd, and I have a lot of respect for him, not Stu Kidd, the Energetica guy that's doing the analysis for the LNG for the government, I have a lot of respect for his work, and they're saying that they can probably get something online within 6 months. I think that's probably a little bit optimistic, but I still see that we've got a real severe fuel shortage running into next year, and potentially even this year if my moon man weather forecasting turns out to be correct, which is actually usually pretty good, then there's not a lot of rain in September, and we're going to dig really deep into those lake levels, and it's going to be problematic.
And going by NEWA's records of giving us the true information, Larry, I'd be very happy looking at the Moon Man Ken Ring's almanac more than NEWA's capabilities. I had to put that in, throw that in somewhere.
I do a little bit of hobby farming, and so I use it quite a lot to see when I'm doing things and when, what's coming. And he's pretty good within a day or two. You can predict,
Ken Ring would be better than NEWA any day.
Yeah. Within a day or two, you can get an actual weather forecast from that was done a year earlier, which is
phenomenal.
Well, we would like to think that this wasn't a shooting yourself in the foot exercise by the previous government, but I'm sorry, Jacinda, and all your mates.
I think it's an over enthusiasm in the market, right? And
idealism.
I'm all for the free market capitalism. That's my preference any day. But when it comes to things, I think we have the discussion around electricity wrong, right? We shouldn't be looking at it as a commodity. We need to be looking at it as infrastructure. It's so critical to everything we do in this country. That and gas, we've got a lot of industries are just super dependent on that. I don't know if you saw, I wrote on some of the greenhouses are struggling as well to get gas for their CO2 generators and their heating systems. Even now the government's having trouble renewing contracts for gas supply for hospitals and schools and stuff like it, heating. So it's critical.
It's fundamental for what we do in our everyday lives. And when I analyze it too, Larry, New Zealand exports energy. That's what we do. Doesn't matter whether it's meat, milk, wool, or aluminium. It's all exporting energy. And how do we get that energy? We actually derive it from the use of the environment, actually. It's just this denial that you can't use the environment for your daily life. Well, we all do, but there's a lot of people in denial.
Everyone's doing that ultimately. That's the thing, right? Even the tech industry now, and you mentioned it, the server farms and all these sorts of things. It's they just use so much energy.
So much energy. Hey, we'll have to call it quits there, but fantastic having you back on. Let's see how this evolves, and let's hope there is a massive snow melt.
But there's Not much, no, at the moment.
No, I'm counting on global warming to do its thing here, gentlemen. Yeah. Might get some. Yeah.
I had a look. I had a look at the snow levels when I was thinking about this and for the Waitaki catchment for the South Island lakes here, and it's below. It's off the chart low as well. So below anything we've had for this time of year. So that doesn't bode well either.
No, it doesn't. So look. Fingers crossed things will come right, but the stresses on industry and commerce at the moment are severe, and let's hope it doesn't impact the mums and dads as severely in the months ahead. So
yeah, I hope so too, Don. I really do. I think we need some wins in New Zealand. You know, we need to get we need to get positive and get our mojo back, and this isn't helping. So and I feel for everyone trying to do business out there in these conditions. It's really, really difficult. So
So thanks for coming back on, and let's hope that we can blow some fair winds across New Zealand. Thanks for it for coming back, Larry.
Thanks, guys. Always a pleasure to talk to you.
Thank you.
Right now, free speech is under heavy attack in New Zealand and overseas, with governments constantly devising new ways to enforce censorship. To make sure you never miss the critical news and breaking stories you rely on, join the RCR mailing list today. Get connected now at realitycheck.radio/email.